You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's pod is Eric Ledru. Eric played a pivotal role in helping the media company Religion of Sports win two Emmys for Tom vs. Time and Man in the Arena. Before joining Religion of Sports, Eric was a photojournalist and a U.S. Army veteran who transitioned from the chaos of combat to the chaos of filmmaking. He ventured into the sports industry by copywriting branded content for Nike, National Geographic, Disney, Mountain Dew, and Bravo TV. He wrote and co-directed Alex vs. A-Rod for HBO, a fantastic documentary that looks at the life and career of Alex Rodriguez. I know you're going to enjoy the pod. Eric Ledru, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So many of the training programs, these sort of bespoke training programs that we start at Second City, happen because certain populations find their way to taking classes at Second City, and we only find out later that like they're all do the like some psychiatrist had people come here for group to deal with their social anxiety. So we start an improv for social anxiety program. Some years ago, we found a bunch of veterans were here. So we started doing a veteran program.
Oh, my God.
So I'm curious hearing that, because you're in the arts like I am. How much of that experience did inform you going into this field or the way you exist inside the field?
Just to be clear, you mean my combat experience, military? Yeah, I mean, honestly, it kind of made it a fait accompli, you know, like it's kind of hard to, once you do something like join the U.S. military, and specifically I was a combat photojournalist in the U.S. military, those weren't actually separate. That may not have been clear from my bio, but, you know, I enlisted and then, you know, I got a certain whatever number on the test scores and they were like, you know, you might be wasted on the infantry. No disrespect to the infantry. I spent my whole time enlisted wishing I was in the infantry, but you know, they offered me a list and I was like, I would much rather like write and take photos, you know, than, you know, be a grease monkey or something like that. So, you know, once you do that and then get out and then go to college and try to find your way in the world, it's almost like it just, you know, just follows you everywhere you go. So there's no doubt that it led me to this moment, you know, in every way. And actually, I have a story I'll tell you later that is directly related to that. So we can come back to it.
All right. So I didn't realize you were a photojournalist in the Army. And what immediately I thought of was some years ago, we were looking to shake up the photography of Second City because in an improvised art form, anything can happen. And the photos were very staid. And we ended up hiring this guy, Todd Rosenberg, who's become a friend. He does all the photos for the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, amazing.
You're right. So you can imagine, right, that chaos that he's trying to capture, and they're beautiful. His shots are beautiful every week, and especially with what, you know, the last couple of weeks for the Bears, unbelievable. And he brought that spirit to shooting, you know, these theater artists. And I know they're worlds apart, but you get what I'm talking about.
100%. I mean, it's kinetic, you know, like it, movement in space, real time. You know, every heartbeat changes, you know, what follows, right? So I, you know, without trying to hit it too on the nose, like when I transitioned from sort of like being a generic, you know, the role is called story producer in the kind of like docu-reality world, it's writing. I don't appreciate being called a producer. In fact, I resent it, but, you know, no disrespect to producers. They're essential. That's not what I do. You know, I architect narrative, to not sound too pretentious, or maybe way too pretentious, but, you know, like it's when I transitioned to, you know, I got some work copywriting as my sort of like bio probably mentioned, and you know, landed these kind of like Nike spots, and immediately, you know, it just felt like working on an action film, honestly, like to be, you know, not too reductive about it. And it was just, you know, incredibly, just kinetic. That was the operative word, you know, and it felt, just like getting to kind of almost like someone giving you all the raw footage of like a, I don't know, pick your favorite action film director, you know? And you just get to mix and match and figure out like, you know, what you get to do, you know, with that. Or if you've shot it yourself, you know, obviously you're, you know, able to craft something a little bit more dynamically within the frame and then, you know, piece it together as well on documentary side, especially like, unlike, you know, your, collaborator who shoots for the Packers. You know, he's like capturing the images. That's another level from a lot of what is done in the, especially the sports part of the documentary world, where you're often, you know, working with like leagues and organizations who have their own internal people, you know, who probably employ, you know, your colleague. And, you know, so oftentimes you're collaborating sort of like with them very lightly and respectfully because they do this every day, and this like the volume of reps that they have, like there's no possible way, you know, no matter what your story chops might be, that you can sort of match their ability to capture something as kinetic and alive as sports or, you know, in your case, improv.
So this is interesting because it's my perfect follow-up because my wife, Ann, runs a comedy major, right? So she at Columbia College here in Chicago, and she does what she calls comedy cross-training. So they learn to do stand-up. They learn improv. They write. They have to do – they put up an original show, so they produce. So because, as you know, in the industry, it was kind of always this way, but is absolutely this way now. You don't know where you're going to end up. You have an idea of a thing you want to do. And, you know, I look at your credits and I'm like, oh, you've kind of done it all. And so I'm wondering how you see that come together. Is it like Legos or is it completely disparate?
By that, you mean like just sort of the path that's led me here, the credits that represents? Yeah. No, it's like breadcrumbs, you know, you know, I mean, I think this is probably, you know, very much probably in the spirit of what you preach, but like I was humbled very early getting out of college thinking like, okay, I'm a combat veteran and I like, you know, whatever, got 2 degrees in X amount of years and wow, I'm just king of the world. And then, you know, the real world just really did not give a shit. And, you know, it was very humbling for me. I was fortunate, I think, to be humbled, you know, that early in life. But, of course I have to continue to relearn that every day. You know, once I kind of spent a deal of time, you know, struggling, I mean, it was hard for me to get a job as like a security guard out of college. You know what I mean? It was like, it was kind of like the depths of the recession after 2008. So this was like 2010, you know, and it was just like a horrible time in the job market. And so, I mean, it was hard for me to get work of any kind, let alone in what I studied, you know, filmmaking. And then the first, you know, sort of like, sort of gig that was tangentially related to it that I got, it was like, you know, required a degree of like mental flexibility. And I had to sort of just like adopt by necessity, a sort of like go through the door that opens mentality, you know? And as long as that door is moving me sort of like one step closer or pointed in the direction that I hope I am going, you know, then that's good enough, you know? And I guess, you know, and it's not like there haven't been setbacks or I haven't sort of like raged against the machine of life, you know, but I mean, if you had told me even 7 years ago that I would be on a, you know, Second City podcast, you know, talking about an Alex versus A-Rod documentary that I made for HBO, like I would tell you you're out of your mind, you know. This was not planned by any means.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's good news in some senses. So for Second City's 65th anniversary, I gathered together sort of all the, we have a creative depth group that meets every week. And it's basically all the people who are left from the old days and some of the new creative leaders. And so my first question for everyone, which ended up being the entire podcast, like all we did was what was your route to Second City? Every single person either got fired or quit Second City at some point. Everyone was it was so, talk about breadcrumbs. It was like, but it was great by the end. And people who listened to it were like, well, okay, if that's what it's going to be like. So what was the best foot in the door you got? Like where suddenly you maybe were putting yourself in a position to get on a Second City podcast talking about Alex versus A-Rod, which I want to talk to you about next.
Sure. Yeah. We'll get to that. Oh gosh, let me think. You know, the first thing that comes to mind were those Nike spots, honestly, and not because they were Nike spots. It actually, but what led me to that. So I had a period of time, like I said, of, you know, humbling unemployment, period of time of kind of like middle, you know, I was like a video engineer for Microsoft for like 2.5 years, you know, like writing code. Like, I don't know how to program, you know, like, but it was like, well, it has video in the title, so I'll do it, you know? Yep. And, I hadn't really been, I didn't grow up really watching much television. I was, you know, fortunate maybe to grow up in a household where like I was supposed to read if I wanted to be entertained, you know, that was probably the best thing my parents did for me. I watched a lot of movies. I was a movie junkie, but I didn't really watch television. So I hadn't watched a lot of like reality TV, despite my sort of like combat photojournalism background. I wasn't really versed in unscripted, quote unquote, as it's called, you know, in the industry. And at Microsoft, I was exposed to a ton of like, we're working on just like massive volumes of content at the time, kind of later turned out to be training my replacement algorithm, you know, but like at the time, like just crunching a high volume of video, and there's no more, you know, voluminous, video than throw away junk food reality TV, you know? And so that sort of turned into that. I was fired by Microsoft or laid off, I guess. Technically I didn't do anything wrong, but just, you know, I trained my replacement well, I guess. And the algorithm took over even back then. And, you know, that I was able to just kind of almost like fake my way into getting a reality TV gig because I just thought like it was sort of low hanging fruit. And there was a job posting that I felt that I was probably not technically qualified for, but there's no way I couldn't do, you know? turned out I was totally right about that. But the preface to that was terrible. Working in reality TV was awful. And just not suited to my temperament or tastes in any way. And so I quit that. I did not get laid off or fired. I quit. And I just said at that point, you know, that's all preamble to answer your question, which is to say at that point I said, like, I'm a writer. I'm not a producer. I'm not a story producer. I'm a writer with a capital W. I'm going to plant my flag on it and I'm going to die on that hill. And, I took it as deadly serious as I possibly could. I've always been a good writer, but that sort of like summer of fun employment, you know, I just dedicated myself to, you know, not just writing every day, but like to granularly working on my craft to work my way through like all of the classical, like prose stylistic books, elements of style. I like read one page, you know, and then I would spend the whole day working on, you know, short story or screenplay, you know, mm-hmm. just working on like where to put a semicolon properly or something like that. And I did that for months, you know, and at the end of that sort of stretch, I worked my way through a couple of, I think, The Philosophy of Style, which was like the antecedent to The Elements of Style. I think there was another style book that came after that was a little bit more modern. So it was like three like heavy grammar prose type books, you know, not sort of like generic how-to books, but like really granular. And so, you know, after those couple of months, I just felt completely... I was, you know, I was already a very confident writer before that. And after that, I mean, you know, when you, by the way, just tie that back into my combat photojournalism, when you have to file a story on a, you know, a deadline, even at 19 years old, when you don't really know, but you do know how to like string a couple words together in the English language. And there's like a freaking, you know, Kiowa attack helicopter, like dropping hellfire bombs, like outside the base that you're at. And you're watching it happen out the window while you're writing on your like old Dell laptop, you know, that keeps dying. Like, you don't get intimidated by writing much of anything after that, you know? Yeah. And so flash forward, this is like, you know, 10, 11 years after that, when I sort of like quit reality TV with a capital Q, quit and planted my flag. And just like really, it was almost like a process of convincing myself that there was like nothing I couldn't write. It wasn't like I wasn't a good writer, but I was just going back to the fundamentals, going to like just work on all the basics that way, like, there's no doubt in my mind, you know, that like I can handle whatever. And off of that, I got a copywriting job. Again, kind of, I would say, like, lied my way into it. I technically worked on, you know, a reality show that was like branded by Mountain Dew. I think you mentioned in my bio. And, you know, I said I had like copywriting experience with brands, you know, and that wasn't true. It was basically true. I had worked with brands and I had done writing. I hadn't done copywriting, but that was the thing that like really launched me on this path. Once I sort of made that decision and kind of went back into the incubator and, you know, sort of like took my medicine, I would say this is the, I don't know if it's the end of the path, but this is where the path has led to directly from that moment. And if I had not sort of quit with a capital Q, and committed to like humbling myself in the face of already thinking I was a pretty good writer, I definitely wouldn't, you know, have made it here. I don't know where I would be. I mean, hopefully I'd be somewhere and happy, but probably definitely not here, you know?
Yeah. I think that's the thing I learned very late in my career was that everything that I went through in my life informed in some part the thing I'm doing. And I was thinking the discipline that you get in, you know, an army situation absolutely is an excellent preparation for the discipline you need to write, because writing is hard. I have written a book. It was torture. It took 2 years. It was the worst. And like, and I love to, and I actually do love to write, but when you have to then sort of write in that. And so I'm curious too, where sports figures in, because you've done that feels like a milieu that you're, you know, that you're living in. You always been a sports guy?
No. Actually, now I am quite quite a football fan, specifically the Seahawks. RIP Bears. Yep. That was a fantastic game. I love the cinematic quality of it. You know, I live in Los Angeles and we don't have seasons here. I'm not from here. I'm from Seattle. Grew up in the rain and clouds, you know, so I watch almost football this time of year to like live vicariously and experience the weather. You know, I'm sure, you know, y'all are like, I don't know about that. I'd rather be in LA, but you know, the grass is always greener on the other side of that equation, I guess. But,
I was at that game. It was gorgeous.
Oh my gosh. Really? You don't have frostbite? That's unbelievable. Like,
let's be honest. I was in a suite. I wasn't outside, but it was so like, you know, of course we're like, I think they've lost, but we've been in this situation before. And then Caleb tosses that thing. And you're just like, oh my God. Cinematic is it. Yeah. It was unbelievable. And the place, and the two things, the electricity that happened in that, you know, arena at that moment only equaled the deafening silence when they lost, when the field goal got hit.
I know that feeling. I mean, honestly, like you guys kind of experienced it in the same game, but the 2014 NFC Championship, I hope I'm not jinxing the Seahawks this weekend, knock on tabletop here, but like, you know, like taking on the Packers, down the whole game, somehow that miraculous like Hail Mary in overtime gets caught. They're going to the first back-to-back Super Bowl since like the Patriots did it in 2003, 2004 or whatever. You know, at 1 yard line, best running back, one of the best in history. We're gonna throw it.
Like, what? I know.
Oh my God. So I know those feelings. I didn't have to experience them in the exact same game though. So my heart does go out to you guys. I was rooting for you.
All right, let's talk about Alex versus A-Rod, because I'm a Cubs fan. I of course knew who Alex Rodriguez was, of course, but I didn't know the full story. And I guess the biggest thing is like, it's so honest. Mm-hmm. And how did you know it was that he was going to be willing to be up for that? Did you have to do prep work? How did you even enter that experience?
I mean, you know, well, there's maybe two parts there that if I could, you know, be a bit of a writer and like structure it just my answer just a little bit prematurely. But, you know, I entered it by just his name being brought to me at the company Religion of Sports that produced it. I've worked with the owner of the company quite a bit over the last, you know, 7-8 years. That's Gautam Chopra. He co-directed Man in the Arena with me. Also Russell Westbrook documentary I directed. And he just floated the name as someone, you know, who was interested in, you know, had a story to tell. And so I just thought about it, you know, and I don't know if it was an immediate yes, but it definitely, it was like almost an immediate, like, this is, mm-hmm. there's something here. Anyways, I felt, you know, so that was And then there's like a long period of development that followed, you know, punctuated by a short burst of anxiety when pitching or having to, you know, rebuild a pitch deck or treatment overnight because someone doesn't, you know, like, I don't know, something in it, you know. But a very long drawn out sort of incubatory time. And, you know, I would say certainly to answer your question about the honesty in particular, that was like just, that was a prerequisite. That was what was intriguing, you know, about him was that he had a bit of a reputation as a, you know, I'll call an unreliable narrator. I'll use the literary term, because I think that's certainly from my point of view, that's how we approached it. And, you know, that opens up a whole, the terrific thing about that is, as a storyteller, that opens up a whole suite of devices that have been thoroughly vetted by brilliant, you know, storytellers for over a century about how to deal with the unreliable narrator as your point of view, you know, and how, what you can do sort of within the world of storytelling to sculpt that and ensure that, you know, that that's like a part of the story that you own. So we both knew like that the audience would perceive him as an unreliable narrator. And that was like a part of the challenge that intrigued us. And on the other hand, we had, you know, we had to be, get aligned, I guess is the word, like just like constant alignment with just like, are we making the same movie? Do we have the same objective here? You know? And it was the operative words were, you know, like honesty, authenticity, you know, the sort of term du jour is raw and they use that a lot. Personally, I don't know how to activate that. You know, I can work with authenticity. I can work with like, you know, protecting the integrity of a piece or of a voice. I can, you know, it's not as actionable to say something's raw. I mean, what, you just like shoot it handheld. I guess it feels raw, you know, and, but you know, maybe that was helpful for him because that was a word that came up a lot that we talked about. And it was just sort of like setting that kind of like constellation of, you know, not any one North Star, but a constellation of stars that we're going to like be headed in that direction, you know? And if any of us feel like we're veering off course, like let's touch home base, you know, to mix metaphors, let's check in and get realigned. And if we're not aligned anymore, if we say it out loud and we're no longer on the same page, then that's a different discussion that we should have right away. And that happened throughout. That was the process. That was the process in the macro. I would say we're all aligned on where we're at and then just constantly returning to that throughout, you know, and it's easier said than done, but it's also as simple as it sounds. You know what I mean? Like you don't have to do much more than that, but you have to do it. And it is really hard sometimes to do that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious too, what the chicken and egg is on the title. Because, man, you know how hard it is to get a good title. And Alex versus A-Rod as a title and related to that moment where you ask, am I talking to Alex or I'm talking to A-Rod, you know, is so beautiful and it points to the problem.
Thanks.
Because he's both, you know, like all of us. We have many selves, and I love that complexity is really sort of it's treated tenderly. Like, you know, you can have great compassion for this guy, and also know he's a rich guy who lied at a certain point, and you know, like okay, so that's it. But he seems like it looks like his kids love him, and it seems like he's trying to find some self-actualization in his life at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with respect to the title, I mean, we just called it A-Rod for the longest time. I personally, you know, do love like those like clean, iconic titles where it's like very singular, monosyllabic almost, especially if you have that gifted in the form of a nickname, right? A moniker. But at some point, you know, we realized that we had been talking about the sort of thematic thread that runs through the series. We just kept calling it like the Alex versus A-Rod thread. And we just like colloquially in conversations, you know, and it just kept coming up and coming up and coming up. And, you know, honestly, like HBO, to their credit, you know, at a certain point in the process, it was time to like sort of formally, you know, baptize the work. And they were like, you know, we all love A-Rod. Are there any other options? You know, we've talked about Alex versus A-Rod a lot. Like, is that a title you guys would consider? And, you know, once that was kind of like spoken into being by, you know, I'll give our executive credit, Bentley Weiner, she's fantastic. And her supervising producer, Abteen Motia, they're, I mean, those guys earned the credibility that HBO has is well earned. And, I experienced it firsthand. And, you know, that was really sort of from them just opening the conversation, you know, and I'd never really, you know, there's always a title conversation, of course, and sometimes it's you just like live with a working title and then you run into a wall and reality sets in that you have to like, well, it's got to have the subject's name in it, right? So that it's searchable, you know, and I understand there are realities to that, you know, but they're rarely like make for good titles, you know? Mm-hmm. And I felt like in this case, I mean, A-Rod is A-Rod. Like, what do you need to do, you know? But to be honest, like when we started thinking about it and HBO opened that conversation, you know, it was fairly late in the process. Probably around the time we locked one or two episodes and we're in the process of locking the third and setting, you know, sort of all the everything that follows from locking your edit. And that conversation became, it happened in earnest. And honestly, it didn't take much time. It was just, I think, frankly, they made a strong case for having a title that was a bit more thematically pointed than something as broad as A-Rod. And in retrospect, I should say at the time, I didn't disagree with them at all. I completely agreed. But in retrospect, I maybe now I'm only realizing like how much that, you know, they were sort of like on the money in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, not like having a more thematically pointed title. That's something we never, there were cuts, especially because there were cuts where that was a bit more of an overt conversation at times. And just by necessity, virtue of, I mean, you know, we had like the first episode, the shortest episode, and it's like 54 minutes or something like that. It was over 2 hours at one point. You know? So, I mean, there's a lot of material we had to cut, just to, not to get down to time, but to just tell the best story, you know? You've written a book, you know better than I do, you know? Like, writing is not just rewriting, it's editing, you know? Mm-hmm. It is revision. It is what you leave out, you know? What is... You know, I have a little like reminder here. Don't break the silence. I mean, the blank spaces, the negative space is almost as important as, you know, the occupied space or the loud thing. And in this case, I felt like the benefit of having that title was that it was a little bit of a pointer towards something we weren't able to as explicitly talk about, maybe honestly better for not being as explicit about it as, you know, we originally had designed. And so now it's a bit like you set that framework for people. My hope anyway is that's the framework in which people, like, you're priming the viewer to approach it that way, right? And then you don't and then it's a light touch, you know. And honestly, like, at that point, once we did decide on that title, there was a point at which we did like another pass and kind of like lightened up a little bit to try and just like not hit everybody over the head with the theme quite so much, you know, to let it be at obviously at times, but, you know, like my question to him that you referenced, you know, it was meant to be a joke in the interview setup. I didn't know he'd use it, you know, I was just playing with him, but it, obviously it works. And it, you know, it kind of alludes to a little bit of like, you know, the tone as well as the theme of, you know, where we might go. But, you know, it's, I was very happy that we didn't have to kind of be as explicit with some of those, you know, some of the interiority that is better, I think, when you just kind of experience it through watching a real person in time and space live through emotions and memories rather than having them sort of narrate it, if that makes sense. You know, and the title does that, does a lot of that, like, sort of preparatory work, I think, I hope.
Yeah, and I think this is misunderstood by the general public and for those of us who create art, is how much it does evolve over a period of time, and that you have to be so conscious of, okay, now that we have this title, it's got to pay off, but if we hammer too much on the nose, it's going to like be boring. And then also, like, I don't know why we have such violent terms, but we call it killing your babies when it's like something so great and it just doesn't
it hurts.
Work.
Because it hurts. It's really hard. That is, you know, from the outside looking in, definitely sounds a bit rich, but when you have to do it, it feels like you're murdering something, you know? Definitely. Yeah. There's a lot of dead babies. There's a lot of, you know, casualties, creative casualties on the floor of our editing room, for sure.
One of the things, this is one of my favorite stories from my days producing at Second City, was it was a show with Colbert and others, but there was a scene called Spelling Bee that got very early, and it killed. It was like closing out the first act, and it was these like sadistic embodied voices torturing these kids in a spelling bee. And what we ended up doing was actually taking it out of the show for like 3-4 weeks during the preview process, not to burn it. We're like, we do not want to lose this. We're going to take it out. We're going to make sure everything else works. We're going to put it back in. And if it works, and it did. And because I've made the mistake the other way, where it's like the best scene suddenly doesn't work. So there's all sorts of games. All right.
That's such an interesting example like that. You don't want to burn it. Are you saving the performers from burning it or from it just kind of like getting out into the popular consciousness? How do you mean?
We're saving the performers from becoming rote with a piece that always kills. Because if it peaks too early, I've just done this for 30 years, right? Longer, 38 years. That if it peaks too early, I'm going to tell you it's 12 weeks into this process, and that's how long Second City takes to create shows. Mm-hmm. It probably won't work. So let's save it. If it's that good, it will. And there's other things that directors do as little tricks. Mick Napier, who's a director I've worked with a bunch, if he has a bunch of like two person scenes, it's like, I can't load up this show with a bunch of two person scenes. What if I somehow put them all in the same scene? Is there a world in which these people exist? So suddenly there's six people on stage. Yes, they're in three different conversations, but you're seeing them simultaneously. And then you're like, oh, that changes the whole thing. So you almost have to, you have to dissect like a psychologist, like a magician, rabbi, all the different elements when you're directing, especially original, right?
Right. That's amazing. I mean, I hear you, describe that. And that's just like another, to me, as confident as I am maybe in talking about writing, that's another level of like, I can perceive it, but like, man, like I know exactly what you're talking about. That feeling of like burn and I've directed scripted stuff, more short films, and sort of scripted commercials. But so I haven't really experienced it on quite the stage or canvas you're talking about. But in documentary, also in interviews, like most of the interviews in Alex versus A-Rod, there were a lot, but most of them were done pretty early on. There's other reasons for it, but the main reason is because you just can't, especially when it's not something that, is a script where someone, you're expecting, albeit professionals, but people to embody, inhabit these characters, learn their lines, learn their blocking, play around, right? Create business, whatever, when it's someone sitting in a chair, the beauty of that, and it also has a lot of downfalls, but the beauty of it is there is nothing that will save you if their storytelling sucks. Yeah. And so you don't get a lot of bites at the apple. It very much is like first take, best take, there's not really a take two in documentary. Sometimes you do pick up interviews and people have watched the show. They'll probably be able to spot them, unfortunately, despite our best efforts. But maybe I do have a personal thesis that, the making of a film, especially a documentary, is a part of the story of the documentary. And, that you don't actually want to disguise the seams a little too much. But I won't digress, too much on that. But in listening to that, that is like another, what you're describing is just like, to me, that is where I start to get like a little like intimidated with like my capability. I hear that and I'm like, man, I wish I was good at that. That's why I asked you that question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, we're known for developing young talent, right? So it's all part of the training process. And the reason so many famous people come out of Second City is the improv training applied in this professional capacity in front of sold out commercial houses. We're commercial theater. We've got to sell tickets. And, you do 8 shows a week for probably like a year and a half, 2 years. Mm-hmm. You almost by default get good just because you have so many, swings at it.
The reps. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that, that you're like, oh, of course, you put this person in a writer's room or on a set or whatever, and they've been thrown so much stuff over their time here, you know, whether it's like weirdo audience members roaming on stage, or, you know, Paul Simon shows up and does the improv set by playing songs and you have to improvise based on him just doing Sound of Silence. That happened.
Oh my God.
You know,
God.
And it's like, you know, so you learn to run with it. And it's funny because the whole reason you and I are talking is our mutual friend, Lindsay Shookus.
Yes.
Let's give her props, because
we should. Absolutely.
I know Lindsay because she was kind of like me at Saturday Night Live. I've always been, I kind of ran the joint, but I had a boss, Andrew Alexander. She had a boss, Lauren Michaels, but she did a lot of the running at Saturday Night Live. And then she was a producer on this, right?
Correct. Yeah. She was, you know, there's several executive producers, but she was the one I worked with the most, I mean, to be perfectly blunt, by a lot. She was, you know, she was on virtually every shoot. She, you know, I talked to her pretty much every day, if not multiple times a day. You know, just, I mean, for me, just speaking from my experience, you know, and I don't know exactly what she did at SNL. I've heard the stories, but obviously I wasn't there, but having worked with her only in this capacity, it was like, she was like a creative therapist for me, you know, yeah. What that wound up being. She came to the project, you know, with Alex, and there's a, you know, a story we could tell there if you're interested in hearing about it, but, yeah. It might be more her story to tell, but I guess what I can say is that they knew each other, from a time in which he was going to host SNL. And then I believe there was a strike. I don't know if it was the writer's strike or the actor's, but one of the strikes shut it down and they were never able to rebook him, but they stayed in touch. And, fortunately for us, like, that turned into, you know, a genuine friendship over the years. And when he, you know, if you've seen any of the publicity he did for the show when it was premiering back in November, it was almost annoying to me because I've heard it so much, but it's also very real. He was like, every interview he was doing, he was talking about how like nervous he was with it coming out, and that it's a little traumatizing and triggering. And, you know, I was, you know, of course, like, I heard that for, you know, 3 years, but it was probably like novel and, you know, quite bold of him to say that, but and that's all true. And the reason he was able to, I think, you know, I mean, not to take any credit away from him, ultimately, it's his life and his story and his storytelling, you know, that powers the piece. But it Lindsay really was the, you know, armature propping him up, or, you know, I think she was a bit of a, you know, almost maybe personal therapist or performance therapist, if you like, you know, for him. Performance coach, you know, and that was a part of it. He's like so used to being coached, and many of these athletes are. And so if you can kind of adopt that mindset working in the sports venue, you know, a sports milieu, like, and especially in my role, like, you know, think of it more like coaching rather than collaboration, you know, even if it is ultimately collaborative, it's just a bit of a different hat you put on. And she was, she was very much like a sort of personal coach to him. And then, you know, ended up becoming very, you know, helpful to me as the sort of, you know, ups and downs of the project began to unfold. And, you know, it was just very, you know, difficult subject matter for him. And that infused the project. And my hope is that, you know, we sailed those, you know, seas, you know, ably, you know, no, we didn't capsize. And made it to port, you know, in one piece, and hopefully delivered something, you know, that's, you know, got real substance. And, you know, and for me, that, you know, I mentioned that constellation of North Stars earlier, being aligned with your subject and the other sort of by the way, it wasn't just Alex, that was with HBO, that was with the company Religion of Sports, that was Gotham and I, that was, you know, my sort of key creative collaborators were, you know, Lindsay, and then the other one I should mention is Kevin Barth. He's my credited co-writer, he's the lead editor on the project and was on it almost as long as I was. You know, that the sort of that trio of people, we were all just kind of like in it together, you know, and they really, if you know, Lindsay was kind of like the bit of the, like I said, therapist for Alex, a bit of a therapist for me, you know, just helping to figure out like what are the issues, what are we hung up on, like how do we get there, you know. And to be honest, you should be talking to her. I don't know why you're talking to me.
I had her on the podcast. She's
okay,
been on.
Great, good. Everyone should go listen to that.
Yeah, no, and see, this is the weird thing about our respective industries, and I've done a little work in TV and film, but mostly theater, is you're working with massive egos, but to make things successful, everyone has to supplement those egos and become an ensemble. It happens. It happens more than you would think it would happen, and it is people like Lindsay, who's a born connector, who's reflexively kind, you know, that where you're like, oh, okay, I don't want to embarrass myself in front of her. She's cool.
Right.
You know, I mean, and so it's stuff like that. Okay. Before I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story, but I have a couple questions before we do that. I want to know the documentarians who inspired you. Mm-hmm. And for me, I thought of three for myself. Steve James, for sure. Mm. Hoop, mm-hmm. Hoop Dreams, Interrupters, A Compassionate Spy.
Yeah, no doubt.
Errol Morris, Thin Blue Line, Fog of War, and of then Ken Burns. I mean, just like the OG of all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is there? Other people who you really love?
I mean, you know, the two that were like, yeah, absolute North Stars for me. I mean, Errol Morris, you know, was a number one. I mean, Fog of War, I watched, I didn't mean to make this like a veterans like therapeutic podcast, by the way, but I watched that like right before I deployed to Iraq. And, you know, it probably was the thing I needed to see, because at the time, I mean, you know, this is obviously a whole can of worms, and I don't mean anything political by this. I was 19 years old and had no idea what was going on in the world. And I enlisted pre 9/11, you know, so I didn't really sign up for this. You know, it was my mindset at the time, but you know, I was in a, you know, personally, like, you know, in a tough place, and, you know, very dissatisfied with, it's why I joined the army, you know, to kind of like try and break out of, you know, childhood patterns. And, you know, when I sat down and watched The Fog of War, I sat down excited, if it doesn't sound sad, excited to like go to war. And I left thinking like, this is not what I thought I was, and I don't know what I'm about to get into now. You know, and obviously that's not a combat documentary the way Ken Burns is, like Vietnam is, or The War even, is great World War II documentary, or any number of other incredible, you know, documentaries about recent conflicts. But just the, like, the way it just showed me something about the nature of war, the nature of mechanized war, the nature of war in the 20th century, American warfare, all that, you know, I was kind of in a military that was in the shadow of that. And it showed me how what I was becoming a part of, like, came into being, you know, and sort of what the architect of that is, you know, what he thought at the time, how that came there to sit, that, like, they were just people, right? Like, making decisions, you know. And so, you know, it really kind of like blew my mind. And that's all to say, none of that would have mattered if it wasn't just like a riveting story. Like, it's a great, great film. And so that both impacted me personally, but it also just showed me like the cinematic potential of the medium, if you will indulge that phrase. Yep. But just that it could be a dude sitting in a chair. And if you have, you know, if it's well shot and an interviewer asks compelling, thoughtful questions and Philip Glass writes your score, you can have an incredible, you know, piece of film that is also resonant beyond just what it makes you think and feel. And so that is the Fog of War for me is like very much like a sort of like inciting incident in this documentary journey. I hadn't seen it since theaters, and I revisited at the start of this project. In part because I watched the other Errol Morris doc that really was influential on this, and probably more directly influential was The Pigeon Tunnel, the one he did about John Le Carre, the fantastic author. I actually just read Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy a couple months ago, like one of the best books I've ever read. And great, I can't believe I'd never. Yeah. Incredible. And you know, that's and again, like the stakes are in, I mean, I don't want to say the stakes are lower. The stakes are like incredible in that. But again, just like, it just showed me like, okay, you don't have to do anything special. And it was a nice reminder, because at the time we were pitching A-Rod, there was a lot of like, you know, like Midjourney was becoming a thing. If anyone's seen Man in the Arena, there's a lot of visual effects in that. And at the time, documentary, I think, as a form, was headed in this much more kind of like, frankly, artificial direction. Mm-hmm. And that was fine for the time. I was riding that wave and enjoying it, you know, and enjoyed making action movies and playing with visual effects. And but when I saw Pigeon Tunnel and then revisited The Fog of War, you know, and kind of like looked at our pitch and sort of like some of these goofy, I shouldn't say goofy, because our graphic designer who helped us develop our pitch deck is brilliant. But, you know, just like almost like trying too hard, you know, to like impress. And it's like, we have a great subject and you know, the intention is right. We're all aligned on what we want to do and the story we want to tell. And it's a very compelling, like, just if it's a, let it live and die on how good of a story it is and like, just relax. And so I, because of revisiting those 2 hour Morris movies, I threw out like a lot of things that we, you know, thought we might play, what we thought we might, you know, film like scripted recreations and stage scenes of things, but have him act in them. And, you know, it's like kind of stuff that could be really fun in the abstract, but when you really think about it and like, you don't need it. And documentary, I think, is best served when you just like stick to things, you know, that's the fundamental promise of documentary, right? It's the opposite of theater or film. The fundamental promise of theater and film is make believe, right? The fundamental promise of documentary is it's real. And so I just felt like that was a reminder to get back to that. And that was like, you know, again, my sort of personal North Star for the project, you know. Ken Burns is the other guy who comes to mind, the other documentary filmmaker. I will admit, I actually haven't seen Hoop Dreams. I am ashamed. I just, it's like 3 hours long. I'm just, you know, and I've watched plenty of 3 hour movies. It's not like, but it's just like, you know, anytime I like queue it up, like on a, you know, whatever Criterion Channel or whatever happens to be on. And I'm just like, what's 95 minutes, you know? I'll out myself in that regard, you know, I owe it to myself to see it for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Steve's great.
It's a great omission. I've kind of been waiting to be asked if I've seen it for like years, and now here we are, and it's on the record. So, but Ken Burns, you know, to quickly pivot away from my admission, you know, Ken Burns is also very influential. You know, obviously he has like, you know, his work and the team he works with at Florentine Films just have like an incredibly high degree of like journalistic integrity. And, but also like, I mean, like my wife was just watching his Civil War documentary, which I've seen several times and love, but I haven't seen it maybe in like 15 or 20 years. And my wife was watching it a few months ago, and I just like sat down halfway through an episode and just like the wit, it's just pictures and music.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, there's like actors reading, you know, like VO, but the VO is from like letters written by real people. And it's, and like, it's just so amazing what you can create in a person's like being or in their mind with something that is, when you actually like break down what the nuts and bolts of it are, it's like it couldn't be more fundamental, you know. It's yeah. So basic. And so I've tried to, you know, especially his documentary The War, that one I actually saw before the Civil War. That might have been the first Ken Burns doc I ever saw, was The War, is World War II one. That was very, I mean, like I can, and that also speaks to me a lot as like a veteran, because they're interviewing the veterans. Whereas in Civil War, right? Like obviously there's no one alive to be interviewed. So it's a very different approach. Even if the result is the same and the nuts and bolts are kind of the same. But I mean, like anytime I turn on The War, like that, like 5 minute, you know, cold open and pre-titles or whatever, like I'm always like sobbing, you know, and it's just like, it's so powerful. And there's real like beauty and artistry and humanity in that. And it's real, you know, and that's what's so incredible about it. Nothing but, you know, his, like, obviously the documentaries that I've done, if people have watched any of the others, if they watch Alex Rezerod, is not quite the same as a Ken Burns documentary in sort of in that they're a bit more subjective. And that's not his MO at all. And I'd be a little embarrassed to ever meet him, because I don't know what he thinks about, you know, what I've done. But there's like a little, you know, people pleaser inside of me. And I'm sure there is. Maybe not so little, you know, like there is a part of me that's like, oh, I'm going to, yeah, I know, Ken, you don't like subjective filmmaking and documentary, but like, man, I'm going to do it so good. You might actually like it anyways, you know, like, and I think Errol Morris to me is the counterpoint in that, like his films are so subjective, like incredibly, you know, but then they have, but then he, you know, like he sort of pioneered not just the Interatron sort of visual of the subject looking at the camera, which he's doesn't even use anymore, by the way. And so that's why I stopped using it. Just copying the greats. But, you know, but his questioning, his use of his questions from off camera, it's sort of like poke and prod and, you know, it, never quite a record scratch moment, but a moment to like, you know, authentically in the course of the authentic interaction of generating an interview with a subject, you know, those moments where he kind of was like, wait a minute, you know, and he kind of, I maybe I'm totally off base, but for me at least, he kind of like pioneered that sort of as a valid device. And that's kind of what I referred to earlier when I said that, especially in documentary, though, I think this, you could make the argument that it's more broadly true, but especially in documentary, that the making of the documentary really has to be kind of a part of the story of the documentary. That's really what I was referring to, is that idea of acknowledging that there's a process of question and answer going on, and where appropriate, where useful, including letting the audience kind of not just peek behind the curtain as if there's, you know, a magician hiding behind there, but more so revealing if it's an opportunity. Only, you know, you want to be careful when you do it because you don't want to necessarily like kill a, you know, great moment, but when appropriate, just like letting people get a little bit of a glimpse of the process of what that back and forth was like, you know, that's a part of it. It's not actually an aside. It's actually a critical part of it, I think.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. I could talk to you forever, but
I know
we're going to wrap up. So last question always on the podcast is, do you have a yes and story for us?
I do. And hopefully a lovely one that ties it all together. In fact, you know, so yeah, obviously, yes, and I learned in taking some improv classes, and it's a wonderful principle I try to apply, you know, professionally, but also personally in my personal life. And the other thing is I learned from someone, I can't remember who, so I'm not going to give proper attribution here, but the like sort of orange theory of symmetry, if I can say that five times fast.
Yeah, that's
like awesome. if you start a sketch, I don't know if you you guys might have a much more elegant term for this, but the way I learned it was like, if you start a sketch with an orange, you can go wherever it goes, and as long as you say orange at the end, the audience will applaud and know that it's over. And I literally like apply that to everything I do. Maybe the story is a little bit of an orange story here, which is that, so I told you earlier, I was a combat photojournalist. I mentioned the writing and sort of some of the conditions in which I would like file stories, you know, but actually for me, the most impactful thing of that experience was actually taking photos. And even though I'd grown up like loving movies and wanting to make movies, I was not a photographer. You know, I had like a little like VHS video camera, but you don't have to pull focus on that. So I did have like a little bit of an eye at the time that I joined the military, but that was really like my writing really struggled within the confines of like, you know, you have to adhere to AP style in within the Department of Defense sort of framework of being a journalist. But it's like very rigidly the AP style, you know. They don't have their own style, but you better, like, you know, if that comma's misplaced, like, you know, you're getting in trouble. Whereas photography was very different. Like, you could, you know, there were certain tenets of like sort of documentation you had to adhere to, but you didn't necessarily have to, there wasn't like a specific style of photography you had to use. So I, during the course of my tour, and probably very similar to just like the number of reps we were talking about with your performers, you know, that you get on a show that you put on, or you know, the Packers photographer, like just the sheer volume of reps you get, like, you know, I must have taken, you know, like 200 or 300 photos a day. Yeah, a lot of them are like on, you know, continuous shutter, but like you're constantly like adjusting even when that shutter is going. So I'll count them, you know, for whatever, 360 something days. It was almost exactly a year I was in country. So, you know, whatever that math comes out to, that's how many photos I took after. I was a very good photographer when I left Iraq, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Since getting to this level of documentary, I've become very detached from the camera. I have a very specific style that I like, and that usually is actually quite versatile project to project. And I love to collaborate with a cinematographer, but I also really like to trust the cinematographer that I hire, you know? And, you know, I'm not afraid of giving notes or direction, but like, I do try to like let the visuals sort of arise organically from the collaboration. That's just my philosophy. On Alex versus A-Rod, I hired one cinematographer, and just these projects go on so long, and you're up and you're down. You're not shooting every day. You might not shoot every month, you know? So people get booked, and, you know, I started out with Lucas Gaff, who's like a brilliant DP I've worked with several times. He shot, like Rap Shit for HBO. So he's unscripted stuff that people might be familiar with. He's just got an incredible eye, but he got booked up, as great cinematographers do. You know, you're happy for him, but it's also like, God, man, come on. I just want a consistent visual style here, and it's your style. And then Brian Robinson came in, and he's also a great, very different sensibility, you know? So for him, unfortunately, he's like having to fill these shoes of a different person, but, you know, also bring his own sensibility to it. And, so there's maybe a little bit of a yes and there, but what I'm actually getting to is, so if you've seen the documentary, there's a spoiler alert here. In episode 3, it takes a pretty substantial stylistic departure from just being Alex sitting in a chair. And this was deliberately designed. This didn't happen by accident. We took him back to Colorado, and he was willing, give him all the credit in the world. And frankly, it might have even been his idea, but he was certainly willing to go back to where he did all this psychotherapy for years with this doctor, Dr. David Schnarch, to the house, who's since passed away, to his old house, and filmed all of the material, or as much of the material as we could, in that house, in the room where he did therapy with this guy. Because I felt like, you know, I felt like therapy is so much more than two people talking in a chair. So if I'm having a guy sitting in a chair talking about sitting in a chair, like, it's just too many layers removed, too much abstraction from the thing. And so we were at least going to go back there and like film around the area, see what came up, get him sort of out of his head, out of the chair. And about 2 days before we were going to do this shoot, one, a blizzard came through and dropped like 4 feet of snow. And this guy doesn't live in Denver. He lives way up in the Rockies, like, I mean, way up there. And so we didn't even know if we were going to be able to go in, you know, and drive in there. We had to hire a snowplow. Credit to our producer, Francesca, and Lindsay also helped her, I think, finding a way to hire a snowplow. But both of my cinematographers said they couldn't do it. And I was like, this is the most important shoot of the project. We have to do this. We have to do like this. Everything's been building to this. If we mess this up, like, then it's, what have we been doing? This is the thing that I wanted to do. This is the reason I did the project, was this shoot, this and this material shot in this way. And I brought in a third cinematographer, and his name is Chris LaMarca, and he actually was just nominated for an Oscar for a movie that he shot called, I always get this wrong, Sugar Cane. I always say Sugar Land. It's Sugar Cane. It's very heavy. It's about Canadian Native Americans and sort of the re-education camps that they went through. It's a beautiful film, but it can be hard to like press play on because you know it's going to be heavy. Yeah. This was before he had been nominated for an Oscar for it. And he's just like looking at all my material, you know, and I'm talking him through things and showing him stuff. And he's in my office, and he looks at me and he goes, dude, you got to do it. And I was just like, what do you mean? No, dude, like, I got to focus on A-Rod. And like, I got, like, look at this list of like talking points, and I got to like fit the snow plow, and where there's going to be 4 feet of snow. And it's, you know, we have like, it's an 18-hour day. Like, I don't, you know, like, I mean, I know I can shoot and I have opinions, but like, you're talking like the level of camera I need to be using to be consistent with what we've been doing. Like, I don't, you know, and he was like, no, you got to do it. Wow. And I just thought about it. I mean, honestly, he said it. He did say it twice. But the first time he said it, I was like, yeah, I'm going to have to do it. And so that is the yes and that I have been building to this, all of the storytelling. I know that was very circuitous, but no, I just said, okay, amazing. I'm going to do it myself. And I did. And I'm glad I did. And honestly, that is, you know, just for me personally, I'm most proud of that in the project. It's not the best shot material in the documentary, but that doesn't matter because I know I did it. And not just that I did it, but that, like, I am a very like tactile person. That's why I like documentaries that are real. Like I said, even if I do scripted stuff, I don't like CGI. Like, you know, I made a stupid little pumpkin short film a long time ago that went viral, and we used real pumpkins. We didn't do CGI. You know, like, I like real things, even when it's for something that's make-believe, but especially for documentary. And so it was just so, it just felt appropriate. Like, the reason I did it was this therapeutic journey Alex shared with us. That's the whole reason I, like, spent 3 years working on this project, was I wanted to get to, I wanted a chance to try and take him and viewers to the point at which this person has gone on this whole journey, and it all comes down to them sitting in a cold room in the mountains, you know, and the movie God smiled on us and dumped 4 feet of snow, and they smiled on us again and gave us a snow plow. And then they said, you got to do it. And I said, yes, Aunt. So
I love it. That is that's the best way to end this conversation. Alex versus A-Rod is the latest on HBO. Eric LeDrew, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much. I hope people enjoy it.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.